From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In just an hour, against a backdrop of the Statue of Liberty, President Bush will address a somber nation. It's been a long day. Now, the ceremonies are almost over. The bagpipes are winding down, the wreaths are laid, the names read, the end written perhaps to one chapter of the country's relationship with 9/11. And the ears open, listening for the president to describe the next chapter, the way ahead. In a defiant speech outside the Pentagon earlier today, President Bush vowed to avenge the lives of those lost in last September's attacks. America's enemies, he told the country's military leaders, will not be stopped by a sense of decency or a hint of conscience. They will be stopped, he said, by a greater force. And so, history is framed. From the Great Depression to World War, from the Bay of Pigs to September 11th, the ways that presidents have led during crisis have defined them and the nation for history. Tonight, we look at how American presidents have fared, how they've led in times of great national challenge. And we ask, what do you want to hear? What do you need to hear from President George Bush tonight? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is presidential historian Robert Dalek. He's professor of history at Boston University and author of several books, including Hail to the Chief, The Making and Unmaking of American Presidents. Good evening and welcome, Robert Dalek.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
It's good to have you. And with us from New York City, we're joined by Amity Schlaes. She's a senior columnist for the Financial Times and author of an upcoming book on the Great Depression. Good evening, Amity Schlaes.
Good evening.
Also with us in New York tonight is our own On Point News analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine, and for these last 3 days, denizen of New York. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Bob Dalek.
Hello.
Robert Dalek, you have written in great depth about American presidents and presidencies and about how American presidents, perhaps any leader, but American presidents in particular, can be, should be, eventually are evaluated. Share with us, if you will, as we think about President Bush and the moment he's at and everything facing us as a country and him as a president, what's the grid of indicators of assessing metrics that you put up against a presidency to assess it?
Yeah, well, it certainly can't be just one speech or a momentary thing. A president to be great or really have an impact over the long term has to enunciate a great vision for the country. Woodrow Wilson was probably the greatest visionary in American presidential history because his 14 points, his idea of a world made safe for democracy, a war to end all wars, these weren't realized, so it kind of puts a certain blight on his presidency in retrospect, but he was a great, extraordinary visionary, and so was Franklin Roosevelt. Indeed, what I've always found striking is that when you have an administration that has some identifiable tag, like Theodore Roosevelt, the Square Deal, and Woodrow Wilson, the New Freedom, and FDR, the New Deal, and John Kennedy, his vision of the New Frontier, Johnson, the Great Society, Reagan's Revolution. You need something that captures the public's imagination and that resonates through history.
We'll set War on Terror aside for a moment to think about it as a tag, but it seems to be the Bush tag so far. But we've got your first metric, and that is vision. What else?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, certainly pragmatism. You need to be a very good practical politician because the cross currents the president has to deal with is a Congress, there's a public opinion, and there's international opinion nowadays. This is an interconnected world so that you simply can't go off on your own as this president is finding, and he'll be going to the United Nations to speak to them tomorrow. So you need to be a practical politician. You need to measure what is doable at a particular moment in time. Thirdly, I would say you need consensus. You need to build support for anything you're going to do. And indeed, that's particularly true of getting into a war that's going to cost the country significant amounts of blood and treasure. Franklin Roosevelt was very sensitive to this after the World War I, the rise of isolationism. He responded by a determined commitment to building a consensus for American involvement in World War II.
Domestic commitment.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. This is essential because in a democracy like we have, you cannot sustain a war effort without that kind of domestic commitment. And Lyndon Johnson learned that to his grief over Vietnam. His support fell apart and his presidency was ruined.
So there's vision, pragmatism, the ability to build a consensus, and your fourth indicator or metric?
Well, I would say trust, credibility. People have to believe in a president. If you overstate your goals, Lyndon Johnson said we'd fight a war on poverty, we were going to win that war. Light at the end of the tunnel in Vietnam, we never saw that light. As one wit said, that sometimes light at the end of the tunnel is from an onrushing train. And Johnson lost the trust of the public. His credibility went down the drain, so to speak. And if you overreach yourself, or, of course, if you lie to the public, as Richard Nixon did over Watergate, you end up having a ruined presidency. So I say trust or credibility is also awfully important.
When these four come together, we saw today, as Abraham Lincoln's words were read a century and a half after they were first delivered, when these four come together, the impact can be huge and very long-lasting.
Oh, absolutely. These, I think, are at minimum the essential ingredients of an effective presidency. But, you know, you also need an element of luck because Herbert Hoover was extraordinarily unlucky. He was a very intelligent man and quite progressive in some ways and found himself trapped in that depression and couldn't get out. Jimmy Carter was unlucky. But it's not simply luck because, after all, Herbert Hoover and Franklin Roosevelt faced the same dilemmas, and Roosevelt turned out to be a great president, and Hoover was a failure. So, yeah, luck is important, circumstance is important, but what a president brings to office, I think, is even more important.
We're not even halfway through George W. Bush's term yet, but events have been momentous, and our sense of need for top-flight leadership now is acute. Is it too early to be assessing George W. Bush according to your grid of presidential qualities?
Well, I'll be equivocal here and say yes and no. Yes, in the sense that I think he responded quite effectively in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, enunciating a vision, rallying the country to bind up its wounds and confront the difficult future that we have to struggle with in this conflict with terrorism. But I think there has been a certain diminution in his standing, in his hold on the public. Bin Laden has not been captured. We passed through this economic crisis. Well, it's not over, really. This corporate corruption, his domestic agenda has been sort of pushed to the side. And what polls are showing is that for all the concern about the war on terrorism, there is a continuing and ongoing commitment to building our domestic reforms or changing our domestic life, improving the economy. And a lot of people now are saying the country is off on the wrong track. And so that's not good news, Mr. Bush. And I think for the moment he will sort of get back on track, so to speak, with the public. But whether he can sustain that is another matter. And now, of course, we're going to have this continuing great debate over what we do about Iraq.
Amity Schlaes, what's your assessment of George Bush so far? He's had these hugely impressive poll numbers since his initial response to the attacks of 9/11, but inevitably those slide down as the months go by, and it seems to be open season again, at least in the media. Time magazine last week referred to George Bush's strange little presidency, which seemed very hard words. What's your sense of how effectively George W. Bush is leading, has led through this completely unexpected, unpredictable crisis?
Well, I would say he's in the process of assembling consensus. We spoke about consensus. Mm-hmm. He's trying to assemble that. So he's not really at a point where he can be judged. But it's important to recognize that the level of support the president enjoys for his position vis-a-vis Iraq is much stronger than the level his father enjoyed in the fall of 1990 during Desert Shield. We forget that. And if you go back and look at the poll data from that period, the last time we had a war before us with Saddam, there was much greater division. There was the fear, the sense that Congress would not support the president. Mm-hmm. I think this time there is the sense that Congress will. We've passed already the debate, does the president have to go to Congress or not? There's a strong feeling of support. Basically, you see Democrats who opposed the idea last time. For example, Dick Gephardt, mm-hmm. who actually said on television during Desert Shield, we might withdraw funding from President Bush, number one, Bush 41, if he goes to war without our congressional consent. Now Dick Gephardt, the same fellow, is on the other side, being rather supportive over and over again in formal public presentations.
But there's the whole back channel, even Republican back chatter of second guessing, of second thoughts. This notion that perhaps George Bush was perfectly tailored, as Time put it, for the black and white moment of last fall. But now, when we're in shades of gray, does he have the stuff for this moment, or is he just the right character because he keeps the world black and white?
Well, but don't you think, Tom, that every president before a war, if there is going to be a war, goes through this moment of doubt, absolute impression of uncertainty, the forces are not pulled together? Mm-hmm. What is so unusual about this? Maybe Bob has a view on that. I think this is fairly normal. It's a big undertaking. Is it right? Should we? Is it? Yeah, is it? Would it be useful? Is it very dangerous? All these questions are naturally there for all of us.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. There always is there are moments of doubt, but I think that this is true, that he does enjoy or will enjoy greater domestic support than his father did, but unless he can convince the international community, I doubt that he's going to get the kind of support around the world that Bush was able to mobilize for the Gulf War in 91. So there seems to be a split there. Now we'll see what happens with his speech tomorrow and what
happens. And tonight, in less than an hour now.
Yeah, yeah. But the whole question of whether he's going to be able to mobilize international support, because there's a lot of resentment out there in the world toward the United States currently. And it's surprising because initially after 9/11, there was a lot of very warm support for us. And this is eroded. And I think Iraq has been a real problem for this administration in dealing with the world, aside from Tony Blair. But even in Tony Blair's constituency, there are a lot of there's a lot of complaining there.
Jack Beatty, what do you want? What do we need from the president? We're closing the anniversary book today. It's a changed world, we're told. What do we want? What do we need?
Oh, well, I guess I would like the president to spend, really I'm just following what the New York Times in a very good editorial on Sunday said, sympathetic to Bush, but feeling that he has not spent his political and moral capital. He has not invested it in what people were saying after the attack, which was, we've discovered the world, which was, we've discovered our interdependence, which was that we have discovered the need for a sort of civic revival. The Times pointed out that the president spoke about that, but in fact, there's only 7,000 people still in the Peace Corps, and the domestic program has more. But there's not been an effort to ramp that up, to try to funnel the idealism that people felt. Certainly he hasn't used his political and moral capital to rally the people around any sort of energy policy that makes sense in a world with this madness going on in the Middle East. And I don't think he's really done it with what's at stake with a war in Iraq. I mean, he's made assertions about Iraq, but there's been no argument, nor has anyone from the administration actually said, well, here are the downs, here are the risks, and here are the benefits, and here's how they compare. There's not been much rationality about it, rather than the statement has been, it's evil, we have to destroy evil. Well, often in destroying evil, you can do evil. And I think that's what a lot of our international friends are feeling now. So I think, well, it's an opportunity for the president now, I think, to to sort of step up to this to the point that history has taken him.
We're talking tonight about American leadership in crisis. What do we want and need from the U.S. president? How do you rate the leadership of the president since 9/11? And what do you want to hear from George Bush tonight and in the months ahead? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American leadership in crisis. And the question is, what do you want to hear from George Bush tonight and in the months ahead? Is America getting the leadership it needs to fully respond to September 11th, to the new world we inhabit? And what is the core of what matters now in presidential leadership for you, for the country? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Robert Dalek. He's a presidential historian and author of Hail to the Chief, The Making and Unmaking of American Presidents. Also by Amity Schley, senior columnist for the Financial Times, and by our own Jack Beatty. You can join us as well at 1-800-423-TALK. Chris is on the line. Welcome, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I think one of the greatest qualities of leadership is really being able to lead towards something as opposed to being able to lead against something. I think that there were a couple of examples of this early on after September 11th, particularly when there was a backlash against the Muslim community, mm-hmm. and President Bush, amongst others, really came out and said, we as a nation need to come together. I think where I personally would love to see President Bush and in general the country headed is thinking about where we can lead in the international community instead of where we can point the finger and say, this is what needs to change and this is what needs to change. I'm thinking of Iraq, and I'm thinking of the Kyoto Protocol, and I'm just thinking of all these places where we have put ourselves outside the international community. So that's my comment, and I'm just interested to hear what the people there have to say about what his opportunities are to lead towards something.
Chris, thanks for your call. Robert Dalek, how about it? Do you share Chris's observation that he sees George Bush as leading against things more often recently than leading toward things? Do you share that observation?
I think Chris's point is very well taken. And I think that's been a recent limitation on his leadership, and he's going to have to find some much more positive program. For example, to elaborate on that just a bit, mm-hmm. I've been troubled by the fact that no independent commission was set up to look at the failings of the CIA and the FBI. Now, Senator Shelby, in the story in the New York Times about him a couple of days ago, said that he doesn't think we're going to be able to finish this. The Senate's not going to be able to finish the investigation by the time it goes into recess later this year. And he agreed to the proposition that we should have an independent commission. See, rather than going after Iraq, I think this country might do much better to build up its intelligence agencies to a point that we can be more trusting of its ability to blunt such potential attacks, you see.
But Dick Cheney would say they're working on, they're striving for a nuclear weapon. Intelligence won't take care of that. Only going in and dealing with the material situation on the ground.
But my argument here would be, yes, they're striving for a nuclear weapon. They don't have it yet. Let's say they get one. What are they going to do with it? They're going to threaten to attack the United States? I mean, we can incinerate them. After all, we passed through that era when the Soviet Union had massive capacity to create havoc in this country by a first strike, China's nuclear capacity. North Korea is ahead of Iraq. So I don't quite understand this proposition that they're going to be able to blackmail us if they get a nuclear weapon. Now, I don't favor them getting a nuclear weapon. I'm not eager to see them obtain this. But I'm hard-pressed to understand why they no longer see deterrence and containment as working. Because Tom Friedman in the New York Times said the other day that this fellow Saddam Hussein is homicidal, but he's not suicidal. And I think that's a very fair assessment of the man.
Amity Schley's, what about our caller's observation? He sees George Bush as leading against things, not toward or for things. Your assessment?
Well, the president, I think, believes that leadership is defined in protecting the United States from and its allies from another such attack.
Mm-hmm.
That's leadership. It's not laying wreaths.
Mm-hmm.
Laying wreaths is valuable socially, culturally, emotionally. But what's the most important thing to do? It's to prevent that attack.
So you're saying let's be practical, not too idealistic at the moment.
And then as much as we would desire to be idealistic, usually if you have the impression of such a threat, as the administration does, you want to remove that threat before you move into magnanimity, nation building, and so on. You can't send the Peace Corps to the Middle East now. Or at least it would be very difficult to do that in a large way because so many of the Peace Corps workers would be vulnerable to be taken hostage. Mm. We have a Middle East right now where you have a situation like Daniel Pearl. It's not a place for to just go and be a missionary for democracy.
Jack Beatty, what about it? Amity Schley says it's not time to send the Peace Corps. It's not time for high-mindedness. We've got a practical problem, a threat to the country, and it sounds like maybe it takes a military response to confront it.
Well, it certainly does take a military response, but I think it also takes sort of an understanding of where national security lies in the modern world. And I'm afraid that just at the moment when our allies have begun to see that that security really can't be achieved at the level of the nation, and of course in a world of interdependence in trade, of environmental interdependence and so on, that's clear. But even at the level of security, the United States is now back to the old European pattern of asserting sovereignty above all. And we're playing different music to their lyrics. Now, maybe they're out of step, but I don't think so. I really think we had Joe Nye on our program a while back, and he made the point, and I think he's absolutely right, that our strength, anything that weakens our ties with our friends weakens our security. That the Europeans, as the American right, of course, depicts the Europeans as a fetter on Americans' ability to defend itself and lily-livered and all the rest. But, of course, those fetters are also our supports, as Frank. And of course, it was our architecture. We heard from David Kennedy last night. It was our international architecture that helped to bring about the very international institutions.
NATO, World Bank, and all the rest.
That the president, in many ways, is undercutting or ignoring, so.
But when towers come down in New York, people do tend to think about sovereignty and about borders. Jack, stand by. So many people want to join this conversation. Let's open the mic to them. Sarah's on the line. Welcome, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to just comment a little bit on George Bush's inability to communicate and how that has affected his leadership. I just don't think he can rally people because he speaks in such short sentences and he makes such simplistic points.
But Sarah, when he went before Congress a couple of weeks after September 11th last fall, it was a pretty stirring evening.
I can't believe the press thought it was a stirring evening. It was not a stirring evening. He has not moved me at all.
Even on
ever.
That, what's described
Clinton.
As his finest hour? Is
No, absolutely not. And I miss Clinton because he could touch us. And even Reagan, I felt, even though it was Peggy Noonan that did it, mm-hmm. I felt moved us more than George Bush.
So what's missing for you in George Bush's manner of address?
No depth to his thought. No meaning to what he's saying. And he can't capture what this whole thing is about. And we're just drifting. We're looking to other people because he can't do it. And that's why he can't get anybody behind him.
Well, he's got pretty high poll numbers. What do you make of that, Sarah?
I don't get it. It doesn't move me.
Robert Dalek, Sarah, thank you for your call. Robert Dalek, what about President Bush's famously difficult relationship with language and maybe even his speechwriters? When you look at this aspect of persuasiveness and consensus building, how's George Bush doing?
Well, he's been able to deliver these speeches that are written for him pretty effectively, and I suspect he has a certain input to the preparation of these speeches, but I think Sarah is quite right. He is so inarticulate when he is dealing off the cuff with the press. His infelicity with language is troubling. Now, maybe more so to people like myself who put so much stock in language and words and writing books, But I think even then, it doesn't resonate all that powerfully with people. And I just wanted to pick up on Sarah's point. She said she doesn't get it. He has, as you pointed out, Tom, he has 63%, 65% approval ratings, which is well down from what it was, but it's still quite high. Mm-hmm. But I am of a mind to believe that a lot of this has to do with the public's endorsement of the institution of the presidency rather than the man himself.
We will rally around the White House under threat.
Under threat. And it's inconceivable to me, if he were running for president again today, that he would get 63 or 65% of the vote. You see, so I think it's really for the institution as opposed to the man.
Amity Slays, is it possible that there's a blunt truth-telling in George Bush that is responsible for those high numbers that some listeners just don't get, but the American heartland, the red states get?
Well, I'm amused to hear this because I feel like I'm in England. I work for an English newspaper, and the English value very highly the oratory, the ability to speak well.
Do you think
but
Americans
America,
do not?
The frontier land, people value it less. And often I think in the American sensibility, there's the sense that if someone speaks too well, maybe he's a trickster. You can also – there's can, also that he's not sincere.
It can cut both ways, but do you think George Bush's – his bluntness – Sarah's suggesting that his language is a blunt instrument that can't get to the heart of what we're up against now. Do you agree?
Well, we as a nation are trying to figure out what we're up against. What does it mean to be against terror? That's a very, very hard question. Maybe we're against non-democratic regimes who are also threats and who sponsor terrorism. We're at a turning point in history, and we don't really know quite what we're up against. So it's natural that he would fumble a bit. Everyone is fumbling. You see the fumbling, in divisions within the government among perfectly articulate people. But I think that one reason the president enjoys so much support is people sense he is sincere. And you see the same thing with his father. I was looking today at a letter his father, President Bush 41, wrote to his children on the eve of the Gulf War. And he said, I vowed I would never wring my hands over how hard my job is, the loneliest job in the world. And in this letter, President Bush 41 spells ring wrong. He writes R-I-N-G. And there are many other infelicities with language, and yet it's an extremely compelling letter. He's telling his children why he's doing this, and he doesn't want to do it, and he's thinking about the Polish patriots who died in World War II and the gas chambers, and he spells a lot of the words wrong.
And you're saying who cares?
But you don't care when you hear this. You think it's a smart guy who's not perfect with language, because the Bush family all have this language thing.
And yet there's so much to figure out. I don't think it makes one a Londoner to long for a certain precision in looking out at the world. Tom's on the line. Welcome, Tom. You're on the air.
Good evening, sir.
Hi.
You know, I have to kind of laugh when I hear people talk about speechwriters who write for the president, and then he tells us what they said. And what I really yearn for is the truth. And I think if the American public really knew the truth about the issues that face us, we would be much better informed and much more able to vote from a basis of knowledge rather than a speechwriter's words.
So what's missing on the truth front in your assessment, Tom?
Well, I'll give you an example. We invite President Mubarak to the White House, our house, and we feed him, and he's not a president.
The Egyptian president, Mubarak.
Yeah, he's a despot. And he is only in power because we give him $2 billion a year to suppress his own people, which then in turn creates radicals like Osama's right-hand man.
Well, there's an example. Tom, let me put it to Robert Dalek. Robert Dalek, what about this moment? Are there parallels? We all – it's an open secret at this point that the Middle East is – it's not even a secret, that this is not the heartland of democracy, yet the U.S. has big interests there. There are pragmatic reasons for the United States to form alliances there. Are there parallels in history when George Bush has to deal with such a murky area? Is the White House being as straightforward with the American people as it can, as it could be, given all the gray that's out there?
I think, Tom, that most successful presidents tap into the ambivalence that the country has. For example, in World War II, Franklin Roosevelt sustained relations with Vichy France, which was the puppet government, so to speak, of the Nazis. Here he was preaching American support of Great Britain and of democracy and the fight against the fascism, Nazism, and yet he had this relationship with the puppet government of the Germans. And yet there was a certain tolerance for this in the United States, not because FDR was deceiving us, but because it was seen as a kind of practical necessity. So I think there is a certain tolerance for the fact that we are cozy with Saudi Arabia, that we have this relationship with the Egyptians, and that people are at a point saying, well, we need these friends, even though they are hardly democratic countries or governments. And also, if we're going to make the standard that our only friends and allies will be democracies, we're not going to have many close allies in the world.
Jack Beattie, how do you think this administration is doing on the truth-telling front?
Well, I don't know. I don't know the truth myself, so I'm hard-pressed to judge it. And this question of our allies, I mean, we have found out on this program over the last year how what people from the Middle East call the regimes are blamed on us, and how our realpolitik, which, as Bob says, every president, every nation has to practice, how our realpolitik, which is supposed to work for us, has in fact helped to work against us. For example, in the case of Saudi Arabia, they have been on a kind of, on the one hand, they've been our ally. On the other hand, they've been spreading hatred and worse against America and against Israel and anti-Semitism and on and on. And I thought one of the most desolatingly disappointing things the president said, and he was quoted in a Maureen Dowd column to this effect, when someone said to him, shouldn't we ask the Saudi government to stop its support of these madrasas which are spreading such hatred of the West around? Aren't we entitled to say that to them? Mm-hmm. And he said, because Timothy McVeigh was a Methodist, would we tell the Methodists to stop doing what they're doing? We can't interfere with their religion. Well, of course, the Methodists weren't trying to talk about tearing down the West. I mean, it was a desolating, and that's the inadequacy in Bush. And I think it comes back to one of Bob's criteria, and I hope he talks about it, that is character. Bob, what about character as one of your criteria?
Yeah. Robert Dalek?
Yeah, I think, Jack, you make an excellent point because, you know, what I keep thinking of as we're talking here this evening, the comment to Eleanor Roosevelt after her husband died, somebody stopped her on the street and said, Mrs. Roosevelt, I miss the way your husband used to speak to me about my government. Because there was a connection that he made to the public. People had trust in that man. They felt he was on their side. And this is a matter in part of character, of the feeling on the part of the public that this is a steady, reliable, committed leader. And you see, I think that Bush's presidency has somewhat been blighted by these scandals relating to Enron and to Halliburton. This is not going to go away. Questions are going to keep being asked about how close is he to these big business moguls.
Robert Alex, stand by. There's a big agenda, a big buffet all the way from Iraq to maybe Halliburton. We're talking about American leadership in crisis tonight. What do you want to hear from George Bush tonight and in the months ahead? Does the president make the nation, or do you and I? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American leadership in times of challenge, about what we want and need from the U.S. president. Our guests are Robert Dalek. He's a presidential historian, professor of history at Boston University, and author of Hail to the Chief, The Making and Unmaking of American Presidents. Amity Schley is a senior columnist for the Financial Times and author of an upcoming book on the Great Depression. And our own Jack Beattie, you can join us as well. What do you want to hear from George Bush in under half an hour from now and in the months ahead? Is America getting the leadership it needs to fully respond to September 11th, to the new world we inhabit? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Amity Schley's, what about it tonight when President Bush steps to the podium on Ellis Island
at the end of a day that has been uplifting and emotionally exhausting all at the same time, and kind of a sense of a new chapter opening in our response to 9/11. What do you think the president needs to be saying? What themes, what message?
Well, I just want to say two things. One, I just want to reply to that Halliburton point. If the president were beholden to Halliburton or Dick Cheney were, then they would not be pursuing the path of Iraq. Because that antagonizes all the oil-producing countries.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the proof in the pudding. They don't care. These oil guys from Texas don't care about antagonizing our oil-supplying friends in the Middle East.
Which is an interesting point, maybe an indicator that they really do intend to go all the way so that they're sure they've still got access to oil.
Well, right, but what would you have predicted? Oil guys, Texas, not nation builders, realpoliticers. That was their reputation in the campaign, and that's what they said.
We hear all that, and I think we're going to beg to put Halliburton aside for this evening because it's a deep, narrow well.
But to the question of tonight, this isn't merely about the presidency, and it's not really a party political thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's about where we are. We're in the post-Cold War. And you had, during the Cold War, the realpolitik of getting along, and we all see that's not going to work anymore. And maybe we want to be more Wilsonian and talk about democracy, or we want to be more interventionist and be like the Marshall Plan, or the way we were in Japan under MacArthur, nation building in a very aggressive fashion. And that's a national shift that's neither Democratic nor Republican. And I think that's what he has to get at tonight. The part B of this, which the president has not elucidated and needs to be elucidated, is as Jack said, what good can we offer them? What hope, if we're going to be involved in the Middle East, what hope can we offer them, not just war? Now, it's hard to do that at this point, the war point, but that has to come too.
But that's where we are. Robert Dalek, have we seen a president before, or has it happened many times, presidents facing this degree of flux in the world, of having this responsibility to make sense of a rapidly, radically changing world or environment? And can the president, can he do that in a speech? Can he do it tonight?
Well, it's difficult to do in one speech, but I think of Harry Truman and the early stages of the Cold War, and that was a very troubling time for millions of Americans. We had come out of World War II. An alliance with the Soviet Union, this fell apart, and then Harry Truman's famous Truman Doctrine speech in March of 1947, the Marshall Plan in June of 47. So over a period of time, he built up this policy of containment and convinced the people, that the public that he, and the world, that he had a sensible, effective response to the Soviet danger. So I think it's awfully difficult to do in one speech, and it's got to be done over a period of time. But I agree with both Jack and Amity that this has got to be something positive. You can't simply want to beat up on somebody, although there is a kind of impulse in that direction, a powerful impulse and quite understandable. But there's got to be something more constructive out there. Now, as far as dealing with the Middle East, I say to Amity's point, see, I think this administration has been so unilateralist. They're so convinced they can push other nations around, and I think they feel they can push the Arab states into following our lead, and they may well be right, because I have a friend who spent a lot of time in Turkey, and he tells me whatever the reluctance the Turks have about Iraq, they're going to come on board once we insist that they do it.
And maybe that's leadership. Sam's on the line. Welcome, Sam. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, Sam. You're on.
Yes, I wanted to make a comment about George Bush.
Yes, please.
Well, I get so frustrated because I just think George Bush is a man of strong character. He's very decent. He's a good leader. Who the heck cares if he can spell? They did the same thing to Dan Quayle. The poor guy makes a little mistake, and they make him seem stupid.
But Sam, you see George Bush standing up for what you want to be waving right now.
Absolutely, and I'll tell you something else. He knows how to salute, and I'm a Democrat. But you didn't see Clinton with that little flippy flop salute he made. If he was so busy with Monica, he'd have got Saddam Hussein before this happened. It's his fault.
Sam, we've got it. There's a vote for the president and for his simple decency and a man that Sam can trust. He likes the way he salutes Jack Beatty. We saw on television, I don't know if you saw it this afternoon, the president and his wife taking a long walk down the ramp to Ground Zero. And there is a straightforward quality to this man. Do you expect that straightforwardness there again this evening in that simplicity, straight-ahead demeanor?
Yeah, I think that's the virtue of his defects, of his defect. His great defect is vision and language and argument and, in short, all that inspires and convinces people. But his strength is to simplify and to see things in sort of Manichaean terms, good and evil. And, you know, conservatives say, Bill Bennett the other day, good and evil are back. We have our categories and all this moral relativism that's been mucking up our understanding of the world, all of that is gone. We have a leader who finally breaks things down into their elements. And I think that is a function of leadership. The question is, does it answer to reality? Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, the problem the president is having, that his categories and his simple way of looking at the world, they do give us a kind of good and evil, and I think we like that, and that does evince a kind of steadiness of purpose. But the question is it adequate?
And with that, Jack, we are almost out of time. Robert Dalek, I apologize, but I've got to say goodnight to you at this point and hope you'll come back and talk with us again.
Sure.
Thanks so much for being with us. Robert Dalek is a presidential historian, professor of history at Boston University, and author of Hail to the Chief, The Making and Unmaking of American Presidents. And Amity Schles, thank you so much for being in the studio and being with us this evening. It's been great to have you.
Thank you.
Amity Schles is a senior columnist for the Financial Times. She's author of an upcoming book on the Great Depression. Jack Beatty, there you've been in New York, standing, looking into the great hole where the World Trade Center was rooted, standing alongside Americans, taking that emotional journey again today. Do you sense a closure of a chapter here? Is it time? Are we ready to move on to a new phase of response?
I don't think we're ready to move on beyond this. I think this is going to linger, and it's going to become part of the American sort of civic religion. It'll be our Memorial Day, our Armistice Day. This day will be remembered. But the question is, what does the day mean? And does it mean that, you know, that the American people, that the American government is ready to just sort of go out like the sheriff and have its way with the world? And because we face dangers so grave, and you can't understate the dangers when you're here, when you see those buildings, when you see the films, when you see the death, when you see the families with the ribbons, you can't understate the dangers. You can't overstate the dangers. But on the other hand, was the meaning of it that we're in a world that is much more complicated than we ever imagined, and that our actions partly had brought about these reactions, didn't justify them, but in the kind of billiard ball sense of causality, mm-hmm. helped to bring them about. And we're about to take other big steps. And will they have these dire and fatal unintended consequences? I think these are the questions now. And this is the legacy, really, of 9/11. What does it mean to us? And what will it mean to our future?
And yet there is no sitting still. The world moves, and one way or another we have to move with it. Jack Beatty, thank you for being in New York these last 3 days. It's been great to have you there, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, it's been an honor to be down here with these great people.
We're asking what words can possibly capture this moment as the nation marks the one-year anniversary of 9/11. Ministers of all faiths faced that challenge today as they stood up before congregations still struggling to understand what happened 1 year ago. Just over an hour ago, the Reverend James Forbes, Jr., delivered a message of hope to his flock at the Riverside Church on Manhattan's Upper West Side.
Thanks be to God. We've made it through the most trying year many of us have ever experienced. This day of remembrance has met some very crucial needs in different kinds of ways. It's provided an opportunity for us to continue to grieve, to honor the departed, to express gratitude for heroes and dedicated public servants, to continue to analyze the causes and conditions that brought together such horrible evil in the deadly drama of desecration, and defilement. We've had a chance to pause to evaluate the effectiveness of our response to terrorism, of our upgraded system of homeland security. And I think most of us are beginning now, in the closing hours of this anniversary, if we can call it that, we've given ourselves permission to plan more intentionally about where we go from here. 9/11 did a lot of things. It ended the song of those who died. But for many of us who live on, 9/11 did something to us that interrupted our song. Some put their song on hold. Some were too fearful to pursue their purpose given the uncertainty. Some experienced restraint as if they were being held hostage at gunpoint of a terrorist. And with anthrax added later on, some were afraid to breathe. And if you can't breathe, you can't get your song out. I want to close here tonight saying that I know what I'm talking about. I know that in life there are times when you feel like you can't afford to risk singing your song. But we want to start a revolution in here. A revolution not to destroy anybody. A revolution based on the fact that if your song is the only song that can be sung and you are not comfortable with anybody else's song, then something is wrong with you. You may be a potential terrorist if you aren't careful that only your song matters. Oh, brothers and sisters, hear me when I tell you that the revolution is one that God is calling us to. And I, for one, am committing myself by the grace of God to do this.
That was Reverend James Forbes Jr. speaking earlier tonight at the Riverside Church in Manhattan. Thank you for sharing your time with us tonight. We'll close this hour with a piece of music that has resonated with us here at On Point, at Ground Zero, and in concert halls around the country since last September 11th, Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.